Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 5. I'm going to do verses 1 through 15. I'll entitle this section, The New Generation is Circumcised Before the First Passover in Canaan. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Joshua had 12 memorial stones put either on the east bank of, on the west bank of the Jordan River and in the middle of the Jordan River, or just on the west bank of the Jordan River. I prefer the latter alternative. The 12 memorial stones, of course, standing for the fact that God had stacked up the Jordan River and allowed the Israelites to pass, a second parting of the sea, if you will. So now we start with Joshua 5, verses 1 through 3. Now it came about when all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel until they had crossed, that their hearts melted, and there was no spirit in them any longer because of the sons of Israel. At that time the Lord said to Joshua, make for yourself flint knives and circumcise again the sons of Israel the second time. So Joshua made himself flint knives and circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeath Haraloth. Now the kings of the Amorites are mentioned as being frightened of the Israelites crossing the Jordan River. These Amorites are probably mentioned to distinguish themselves from, or to have them distinguished from, the Amorites who were on the east of the Jordan. You remember Sihon and Og, the famous two kings that Moses wiped out on the east side of the Jordan River right before he died a couple months before this. But there were also Amorites on the western side where they were going. John Gill says the Amorites on the east actually were probably a colony of Amorites sent from the west. Now Adam Clark has some Amorites in the west occupying the mountainous country in the vicinity of the western part of the Dead Sea, right to the west of the Dead Sea, which is not too far where they are now. So that's the Amorites. Now, remember, the Amorites were the tribe, a large group of people who actually sometimes occupied Syria and all the way into the Mesopotamian Valley. In fact, they showed up on the Assyrian monuments and the Egyptian monuments. So they were big, but sometimes the term Amorites was just used to stand for all the ites that were in Canaan. Likewise, all the kings of the Canaanites are mentioned, and sometimes Canaanites are used to stand for all the ites. But these are probably the particular Canaanites who were in Lebanon. They were by the sea, which is where Lebanon is now. So anyway, these are the representative pagans that the Israelites would have to wipe out. And they were afraid. It said their hearts melted. No spirit in them. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua in verse 2, this was a good time. Good time to cross. The pagans were in such fear. They've already crossed. It's a good time to have the circumcision. Now remember, circumcision puts your warriors out of business for up to 3 weeks. But they did it anyway. Joshua did it. It says in verse 2 that Joshua used flint knives to do it. Why flint? Stone. Why not use metal knives? They had iron and steel, as Clark put out. The different manufacturers in the wilderness proved that. You remember all the stuff they built for the tabernacle? They had metal. They knew how to work metal. Well, Adam Clark says that it was probably unlawful to use anything but stone. I don't know what he means by unlawful. The Torah, the Pentateuch, didn't prohibit using metal, but perhaps he meant it was not allowed by the Israelite leaders, and this practice of using flint instead of metal was probably reinforced by practices outside of Israel. The Egyptians considered it unlawful to make any incision to humans with metal, and so God is going along with that. When the Egyptians were preparing their mummies for embalming, they didn't use metal, they used flint. Now, stone was probably easier on flesh than metal because a metal wound suffers more from inflammation. Adam Clark says that metal leaves fine particles in the wound, which can oxidize, and I guess that causes inflammation. It doesn't sound good anyways. Anyway, they use flint. Now, we need to look at some options as to why that no circumcision had been done while the Israelites were in the wilderness. Now remember, there was a lot of Israelites that left Egypt. They were already circumcised. But then when they got into the wandering around for 40 years, there were a lot of them born that weren't circumcised. Why not? Well, first of all, let's talk about who wasn't circumcised. Remember, there was a census, and all of the men who were 20 or above were numbered in the census. That was about 601,000 or so. And they were circumcised. Then if you were under 20, and you came out of Egypt, you were circumcised too. You weren't counted in the census, but you came out of Egypt already circumcised. And then during that 40 years when you married and had kids, those kids that were born were not circumcised, probably because they were wandering around in the wilderness and it just wasn't proper time to do it. Maybe because there was a frequent change of place while they were wandering in the wilderness. They never knew how long they would be in one place. Remember, it takes about 3 weeks to heal from circumcision, so they would have to camp for 3 weeks in one place. What happened if they did it? And then the cloud moved, and all the rest of Israel was moving, and you or your sons are wounded and healing up. Now, if this theory is true, that it was inconvenient was the reason why they didn't get circumcised in the desert during the wilderness, that means that God's rituals are subject to veto by impracticality. For example, a believer in prison baptizes with water out of a cup because there's not enough water that's available for immersion. Now, hard cases make bad law. I remember one time I was in China. We were stuck somewhere, couldn't find any grape juice, and had cranberry juice instead. I didn't like it, but we had no choice. There's nothing wrong with that in a case of necessity. But that's one reason why it's just inconvenient, why the Israelites didn't do circumcision in the wilderness, because it was just inconvenient. Or maybe they were just culpable. They didn't care about following the covenant commands. Remember, circumcision was the sign of the covenant of Abraham, and all Israelites were supposed to do it. Maybe God forbade them from being circumcised because they were disobeying, they were murmuring, they were rebelling. Maybe it was unnecessary to distinguish them from their pagan neighbors. Circumcision would distinguish you from some pagan, not from the Egyptians, because they did circumcision, but from a lot of these Amorites and people like that. They didn't do circumcision, but there were no pagan neighbors in the wilderness, so it was not necessary to circumcise. Well, for whatever reason, there were a lot of people not circumcised, and so they needed to be circumcised. Why? Why was circumcision necessary? Well, several reasons. First is, if you're going to do Passover, you have to be circumcised. Exodus 12, verses 43 through 44 says that. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "This is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it, but every man's slave purchased with money, after you have circumcised him, then he may eat of it." And just as the slaves and the foreigners, the sojourners, likewise the Israelites, had to be circumcised before they ate the Passover. And they're getting ready to eat the Passover in 4 days. Probably in 4 days. Remember, they crossed on Nisan the 10th, and the Passover was on Nisan the 14th. Now, there is a speculation that it might have been the second month Passover. There was a provision in Deuteronomy that says that if you can't do it on the first month, Nisan the 14th, you can wait, go to the second month of the 14th day of the month and do it then. But most probably it was on Nisan 14th, and they needed to get circumcised before then. Now, that only gave them 4 days to heal up, and it normally takes longer than that, but they get circumcised on the Passover, and there's a Sabbath after that, and you got a Feast of Unleavened Bread, and, you know, I can see why they would do it right before the Passover. But also, the main reason to get circumcised is because the land of Canaan had been included as a gift in the covenant of circumcision, the Abrahamic covenant, the covenant that gave the Israelites land, offspring, and blessings, and they're about to go into the land right now. Genesis 17, 8 through 10, "I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and your descendants after you," God says to Abraham. "Every male among you shall be circumcised." So you see, circumcision is connected with the covenant, which is connected with the land, and they're about to go into the land, so it's time to get circumcised. Now it says in verse 2 that God tells them this is the second time that they were to be circumcised. Unfortunately, the first time is not mentioned in the Pentateuch. And so we can speculate as to when the first time was, before the eating of the first Passover, which was, of course, in the first year at Sinai after leaving Egypt after 1 year. Since they were supposed to get circumcised for the Passover, that could have been the first time. Could have been in the 3 days of darkness of the Egyptians right before the first Passover, because those 3 days gave them time to heal before they took out the next day, and that actually makes more sense. It could be just before the celebration of the Passover at Mount Sinai during the second year. Again, on the theory that you're supposed to be circumcised before you eat the Passover, and it was time for the Passover. So that's a good speculation. I don't know why it was not mentioned the first time. It wasn't. Now, when God tells Joshua the Passover, the circumcision should be done a second time, that obviously didn't mean that the Israelites were to repeat circumcision on those who had already been circumcised. That could only be possible if the foreskin had grown back or the first circumcision done inexpertly, but that's unlikely. It just means a second time in general for the whole group of Israelites, for them to be circumcised for a second time. Now, these that were under 20 and still alive and passing over into the Canaan line, it would consist of people who were circumcised when they left Egypt and lived all the way through the 40 years, except they had all died. Those who were 20 and over had all died. But those who were under 20 did not die in the wilderness. They were not part of God's judgment after the Israelites refused to listen to Joshua and Caleb and enter into the Canaan land. So there were people under 20 who were born in the desert. They were not circumcised. And then there were people under 20 who had left Egypt and lived all the way through the 40 years. You add those two together, nobody knows how many they are. Here's a quote from Tony Maritis website. Ultimately, there is no biblical account that states how many people crossed the Jordan. Any number offered would be speculation at best. And verse 3, it says, Joshua made those flint knives for the circumcision. Actually, he had them made for him, of course. And the circumcision was done at a place called Gibeath Harloth, which is Hebrew, or not Hebrew, it's English transliteration from Hebrew. And it means hill of foreskins, as the NIV margin points out. I guess there was a big hill of foreskins there with all those Israelite soldiers being, however many they were, I'm sure there was a lot of them, their foreskins were cut and put in a pile there, and so they called it hill of foreskins. We go down to Joshua 5, verses 4 through 7. This is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, died in the wilderness along the way after they came out of Egypt. For all the people who came out were circumcised, but all the people who were born in the wilderness along the way as they came out of Egypt had not been circumcised. Now, I just told you that, but it actually states it here in the text. Verse 6, Joshua 5, For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness until all the nation, that is, the men of war who came out of Egypt, perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord, to whom the Lord had sworn that he would not let them see the land which the Lord had sworn to their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. Their children whom he raised up in their place, Joshua circumcised. Those are the ones that were born in the wilderness and were not circumcised, but they got circumcised here at Gibeath Harloth, circumcised by Joshua. For they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them along the way. Now here's an interesting thought about the men of war who died in the wilderness. You had to be 20 or over to be in the census, and all of those men died in the wilderness before they crossed the Jordan River. Actually, it was before they crossed the Brook Zered, I think, if I remember correctly, south of Moab. They all died. Now, if you were 20 years old when you left Egypt and you wandered for 40 years, you would be 60 years old at the time of crossing the Jordan River, and 60 years old is real easy to live to. So the people who died didn't die of natural causes. The people whose corpses fell in the wilderness didn't die because of natural causes. They perished, rather, because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord. And it says that in verse 6. For the sons of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness, that is, the men of war, they perished because they did not listen to the voice of the Lord. And, of course, the 40 years is a round number. They were 5 days short of 40 years. They crossed on Nisan the 10th, and Nisan the 15th is when they started out for the wilderness, so that's 5 days before 40 years. And it mentions here that the people died in the wilderness because they didn't listen to the voice of the Lord, and the time that they didn't listen to the voice of the Lord is when the Lord had sworn that he would not let them see the land. That was after the spies came back. 10 spies says, the giants in the land, we can't go. Joshua and Caleb said, yes, let's go. We see that in Numbers 14, verses 22 through 24. And this, again, was near the end of the 38-plus years of wandering after Sinai. In other words, probably within the last year from where we are now. Numbers 14, 22 through 24. None of the men who have seen my glory and the signs I performed in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tested me these 10 times and did not obey me will ever see the land I swore to give their fathers. None of those who have despised me will see it. But since my servant Caleb has a different spirit and has followed me completely, I will bring him into the land where he is gone, and his descendants will inherit it. So the Lord swore. And when God swears, that's it, boys. Can't swear by anything higher. And God never lies. And he swore in Numbers 14 that the Israelites would never enter. The Israelites who were 20 and above would never enter into the land of Canaan. We go down to Joshua 5, verses 8 through 9. Now when they had finished circumcising all the nation, they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. Now they finished circumcised. That was either on the 10th of Nisan, the day they crossed, or maybe the next day on the 11th of Nisan. It's not totally clear. Now some people object that all those men could not have been circumcised in the short time before Passover, 3 or 4 days. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say concerning that, quote, it has been calculated that the proportion between those already circumcised, under 20 when the doom was pronounced, and those to be circumcised was 1 to 4. The already circumcised ones were the ones who left Egypt, but they were under 20. But they were circumcised when they left Egypt. And those to be circumcised were the ones that were born during the wilderness wanderings. That ratio was 1-4, somebody calculated, and consequently the whole ceremony could easily have been performed in a day. In other words, only 25% of the surviving males there got circumcised, and so it could be done. And plus, you got a lot of people with a lot of flint stones. You don't have to do it one by one, but a whole bunch of people could be circumcised at the same time. So that's not a problem. Now, how about the healing up? Verse 8 says that they remained in their places in the camp until they were healed. Now, it usually took about 3 weeks to heal, as Adam Clark says. Remember that famous story where Simeon and Levi and Jacob's sons, the two older boys, not the oldest, but two of the older sons of Jacob, got mad because Shechem fell in love with their sister Dinah, and then Shechem overpowered Dinah somehow, either seduced her or raped her, I don't know, but it wasn't done good, and so Simeon and Levi said, let's make a deal with the Shechemites, we'll do a treaty with you, and then we need to seal this treaty with circumcision. And while the Shechemites were being healed up from the circumcision, Simeon and Levi came in there and whopped them with their swords and killed all the male Shechemites. Now, in that passage, Genesis 34:25, one of the verses that tells us about this, it says, now it came about on the third day when they were in pain. So there's at least 3 days to heal up. And Clark says 3 weeks. After 3 weeks, you can walk, but only with great difficulty. So the question arises, how could they do the Passover so soon after 3 days? Well, Adam Clark suggests they could do the Passover on the second month as provided by law. That's in Deuteronomy. You remember that. If somebody was away on a trip or something, or was sick, couldn't do it on the first month, you can do it on the second month, on the 14th of the second month. Adam Clark suggests maybe they were miraculously healed. I don't know. I don't know if you're, even if you're healing up from circumcision, I don't know why you can't celebrate Passover. It might be a little uncomfortable. You know, why can't you celebrate Passover if you got a cold, if you got a stomachache a little bit? I don't see why you can't do that. It's just because you're not being circumcised. Now, another question arises here. The army is healing, and so now the army is vulnerable. So the question is why did Joshua subject the whole of his army to annihilation? Reason number one, he had total faith in God. Reason number two, the heathen were immobilized by fear. Remember Israel's reputation? Their hearts melted. They saw what happened at the flooded Jordan River, that the river parted from that probable earthquake and mudslide, and the Israelites walked across. They were scared. And not only that, there was a practical reason. Remember, I said that there were people who were already circumcised. Some estimates 3/4 of all the Israelite men were already circumcised, so they didn't participate in this circumcision celebration at Gibeath Haraloth. So that means 3/4 of the men were there to guard the camp. So he didn't subject the whole of the army to annihilation. It just, you might think that, but he didn't. Verse 9, the Lord said to Joshua, today I've rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. Now Gilgal sounds like roll in Hebrew, as the NIV note says. So that's where Gilgal comes from. The rolling away of the reproach of Egypt can mean several things. It could be the reproach of being reckoned of the same religion of Egypt, that grossly impure, idolatrous religion of Egypt. But this is Adam Clark's idea. My first question there is, well, the Egyptians circumcised their sons, according to Herodotus. So it sounds like circumcision would bring Israel closer to Egypt, not farther away. Well, maybe the physical act would, but circumcision also reminds one of the covenant of Abraham. So it could be that the reproach of Egypt, the reproach of being under the idols of Egypt when you were a slave, is gone now because now you're associated with the religion of Abraham, which of course is much purer than the Egyptian religion. So that could be. Or it could be the reproach of Egypt, meaning the reproach that Egypt was putting on Israel. People in Egypt were saying, ah, look at Israel, you left here. Now you've come out of the wilderness, you've been wandering around for 40 years, and now you're about to be destroyed. God has forsaken you. Israel's evil. That could be. But I think the third option is best. They were slaves in Egypt. That reproach is gone now. They're free men under the covenant of Yahweh. Whatever it is, the reproach is gone. They are circumcised and ready to go. So there's the name of the place is Gilgal. The Israelites named it Gilgal. Gilgal's mentioned in the previous chapters, but it hadn't been named yet. So they were the author of Joshua was using the name Gilgal in advance. And of course, the place is called Gilgal to this day. If it's Joshua that wrote this, that's about 20 years later when he sat down to write. Or if it's Ezra or Samuel, it's even later than that. We go now to Joshua 5, verses 10 through 12. While the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. On the day, remember, Jericho was very close to Gilgal, about 1.5 miles, according to one Josephus, close. On the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of Canaan during that year. Now, in a previous audio, I said something about manna stopping before they entered Moab, and then I said before they crossed the Jordan. I was relying on my memory, which was faulty. His is when it stopped. They actually crossed the Jordan, had gone over there for about 5 days, had to pass over, and that's when the manna stopped. And in fact, the reason they ate some of the produce of the land is because of the manna stopped, and the reason it's recorded here about them eating, which is no big deal. You eat, so what? Well, it's to show that they're no longer relying on the manna, they're relying on the produce of the land, of the promised land. Now, how did they get the produce of the land? Obviously, they'd only been there for 5 days. They couldn't have planted crops and harvested their own crops. So here's some options. They could have just picked the grain that belonged to the inhabitants, picked the grain that was growing in this, and picked the standing grain, or maybe the grain had already been cut and tied in the sheaves and was just lying in the fields, and so they just went and picked it up. Or maybe they just went and took off some grain in storehouses. Spoils of war, if you will. This was the day after, which I assume is the 15th day. John Gill says it might be the 16th. I don't know how he gets there. It's too complicated to worry about. We'll assume it's the 15th day of Nisan. Notice the manna stopped then. And this is sort of a example of how miracles are not done when natural means are available. And to the contrary, when natural means are unavailable, oftentimes God does miracles. And that's why a lot of times when his people are in a tight spot, you will see miracles done, like Paul. Like, for example, when Paul got bit by a snake and there were no doctors around and the snake didn't kill him, a viper that should have killed him instantly didn't do it. We go now to Joshua 5, 13 through 15, and we will finish this short chapter. Now, it came about when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" He said, that's the other man, said, "No, rather, I indeed come now as captain of the host of the Lord." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and bowed down and said to him, "What is my Lord to say to his servant?" The captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, "Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did so. Well, the first question we ask is, who is this guy that Joshua has run into? Well, there's no question. It's Jesus. It's an Old Testament epiphany of Jesus. We go now, I'll show you why in just a minute, but now in verse 13 it says, it came about when Joshua was by Jericho. John Gill suggests he was probably up there spying out the place, reconnoitering, looking for the best place to most easily enter the city. He's probably praying for guidance as to what he was going to do. Remember, Jericho's a walled city, hard to get into. Now in verse 13 it says that Joshua looked and saw this man. He either saw the man with a sword in a vision, or he saw the man with a sword in his flesh. I tend to think it was in the flesh. Now, as I said, the man was Jesus, as John Gill says. Now, here's the evidence for that. First of all, Joshua calls him Lord in verse 14. Joshua fell on his face, bowed down, and says, "What is my Lord to say to his servant?" Now, of course, it could be that Lord there is just an honorific title, as we say, sir. And so that's not ironclad proof, but Jesus has just said, "I am the captain of the host of the Lord." Well, the host of the Lord, that's the angelic armies of Yahweh. If you look at the Lord is Yahweh there. Angelic armies of Yahweh, that doesn't sound like any old person you say sir to. So when you add that to the fact that he said, called him Lord, and the man said he was the captain of the host, he was ahead of all the angelic armies of Yahweh, that's not an ordinary person. Also, the ground is said to be holy, the man said, the angel of the Lord. The man with the sword said, "Joshua, remove your sandals. The place where you're standing is holy." Well, why is it holy? Because the Son of God is standing there. That's why it's holy. Also, we see Joshua falling on his face and worshiping the man. That shows that the man was God, Jesus. And the final clincher is this, The man says to Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you're standing is holy. What does that sound like? That sounds like exactly what Yahweh said to Moses at the burning bush at Mount Sinai when Moses, at the end of his 40-year sojourn in the capital city of Egypt as an Egyptian functionary, he was out in the wilderness, had escaped from Egypt because he was scared he was going to get caught for killing the Egyptian taskmaster. And he sees this burning bush, and from the burning bush comes a voice that says exactly the same thing. Remove your sandals, Moses. The place where you're standing is holy. So, same things happened to Joshua. It's interesting. Joshua goes across a divided river, and Moses went across a divided river. Joshua is confronted with an epiphany of the Lord, who says exactly the same thing that Yahweh said to Moses when Moses was confronted with an epiphany of the Lord. Joshua is the second Moses. He is the replacement. They needed encouragement badly because what they're doing to take over Canaan was an incredible task, and so they got it. Joshua got it. Adam Clark also agrees that this was Jesus. He says this, quote, it has been a very general opinion, both among the ancients and moderns, that the person mentioned here was no other than the Lord Jesus in that form, which, in the fullness of time, he was actually to assume for the redemption of man. In other words, this is an epiphany of Jesus as a man. He appeared as a man. Now, why did Jesus appear here to Joshua? Well, here's option number one, to show Joshua that God had not abandoned them even though the manna had failed. Some might have thought that God had abandoned them when the manna failed. I guess they might have thought that, sure enough. No, there's still the miracle-working God that's there. Option number two, Jesus appeared to Joshua to give supernatural instructions on how to take Jericho. Now, this becomes clear when you go ahead to chapter 6 and skip Joshua 6:1. And you have to skip the unfortunate chapter division between chapter 5 and chapter 6, which, of course, is man-made by later scholars did that. Joshua 6:1 is parenthetical. It says this, now Jericho was strongly fortified because of the Israelites. No one was leaving or entering. And then when you get to Joshua 6:2, it says, the Lord said to Joshua. Well, what Lord is saying to Joshua? Is that God speaking from heaven again? Or is it the man with the sword still speaking? The Lord said to Joshua, look, I've handed Jericho, its king, and its fighting men over to you. And then he proceeds to tell Joshua how to proceed with the siege. So this was Jesus. This is a no-brainer. Not many people debate that. Why did Jesus have a sword in his hand? To show that he wanted to fight his enemies in Jericho and Canaan. That's a warlike symbol there. Now, Joshua went up to this man in verse 13. And that showed great courage on Joshua's part. And his question showed that he wasn't sure that this was God being on his side. This could have been somebody on the other side. After all, he was around Jericho. Why wouldn't there be somebody fighting in the interest of Jericho, walking around Jericho? And so Joshua had a lot of guts, and he's the leader of Israel. If he'd have gotten cut down there, ooh, Israel would have been in a bad mess. But he went up to him with great courage. Joshua was a man of courage. And his question also showed, his question, who are you? Who are you? Whose side are you on? That question showed that Jesus' appearance wasn't as a glorified man. It was as an ordinary person. Because if he was glorified, he wouldn't have any question whose side Jesus was on. Now, Joshua obviously thought the man was a warrior because he said, what side are you on? What side are you going to fight on? He might have thought that it was a single warrior sent out from Jericho to do single combat with Joshua. You know how in ancient times they would do that? In the Middle Ages, they would always request that. Let's have a champion come out on your side and our side, and let's fight and save all the carnage and the killing. But they hardly ever did that because everybody was scared to risk their whole army on them on a solitary fight, a sword fight. David and Goliath, that's what happened with David and Goliath. Mano a mano. He might have thought that, or he might have thought it was a Canaanite general come out to scout the Israelites' camp. As I said before, he wasn't sure what side Jesus was on. Now, I said earlier that Jesus said he was a captain of a host of Yahweh, the host of all of God's angels. That's usually what the word means in the Old Testament. It could mean, however, the host of Israelites, or it could be the Israelites and the angels together. I don't think so. I think he's talking about angels, a multitude of angelic soldiers. Now, in verse 14, Joshua says to Jesus, what is my Lord to say to his servant? And what he meant by that was, what command will you give so that I, Joshua, can obey? He's looking for instructions. He wants to obey. And then Jesus says to remove your shoes. This was a trial of obedience. Are you going to obey me, Joshua? And since shoes walk around in the dirt, they tend to be dirty, and that's what profane means, of dirt, dirty. You remove your shoes because you're walking around on a holy place, and dirt doesn't belong in a holy place. The profane does not belong with the sacred, if you will. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are now prepared for the Siege of Jericho, which is coming up in our next audio, chapter 6. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.